Oliveira, thank you very much for joining us. Would you tell me, firstly, the area of interest you have in psychology?
I have always really, even before I knew that psychology existed as a sort of university study, I've always been interested in this area of how people begin to think about God. I started being interested in it because I started noticing differences. Some children did believe, some didn't. Some adults did believe, some didn't. So I developed an early interest in that kind of a problem. And then within developmental psychology, really, there were other conceptual issues that seemed to me an obvious part of it. So I began to work on.
When people hear psychology of religion, they often immediately think of the famous Sigmund Freud and his view, I think, that religion was a kind of neurosis, a longing for some parental figure. Yeah. Is that view still widely held? Does the shadow of Freud still...
Not really, certainly not in Oxford or in scientific psychology, shall I put it. I think those psychologists who have clinical interests and deal with people who obviously have had some childhood unpleasant experiences might look for something there, but that's not very common. Certainly there is hardly any kind of research really supporting it in a systematic fashion. It wouldn't be a normal course of development, let me put it that way.
You made the headlines recently, certainly in Australia, by reporting research that concluded children naturally incline toward a belief in some kind of creator. Before we talk about the details of the findings, can you first tell me about the studies behind this claim?
Well, I think the claim really should be viewed, this is now talking about mainstream developmental psychology, how children develop concepts in general in any domain. It used to be believed some decades ago that children are born really tabula rasa, so it all depended on the environment, on stimuli, provided early on. We now know that that is simply not the case. In fact, to a large extent, thanks to the modern technological developments, there are possibilities of recording very fine, minute perceptual responses that infants make, newborn and so on, so that it's possible to get very meaningful patterns of children's responses to different situations, different stimuli. And one of those early discoveries about early development is that children seem to make sense of the world in causal terms. They seem to understand that certain events have certain types of causes and are not prepared just to put the two together because they happen to occur quickly in time or close in space. So clearly, the question arises then whether children ask causal questions about the things that are not so immediately explicable in terms of any obvious causes. And that is where quite a lot of interesting research has really taken place, mainly with children of preschool age, younger preschoolers, but infants as well. For example, babies, preverbal infants, show evidence of clearly expecting that certain types of events follow, given what preceded those events. If that doesn't happen, they are surprised, and these are measurable responses in children. When they begin to talk, that's where opportunities for research increase really rapidly, and you can then ask them questions. And those studies by various researchers now, mainly from America, Canada, in this country as well, show that children have a fairly sophisticated way of understanding causation. In fact, they develop theories about what causes could be. So the question is now, how do they begin to do it? There must be something that they start with, some kinds of assumptions or predispositions that they bring with them to the world in order to begin to make sense of it. So that's, I think, where the consensus among developmental psychologists now is. I have simply found that framework the most meaningful for me to begin to look at their early acquisition of religious understanding, because I have really always been interested in what about religion that humans can know is independent of culture, what if anything. So that was my interest, and that somehow fitted in with natural theology that scientists of the 16th, 17th century have always thought about. And of course, causal understanding is then the obvious concept to bring into that. So that's how I have situated my own research within mainstream developmental psychology.
Am I right in thinking that one of the studies that revealed this belief in some kind of creator was conducted even in Japan, where
right.
in the culture there isn't a great encouragement to believe in a creator.
That's
Could you tell
right.
me about that?
Well, that's a very interesting sort of history to that study. I just, as I was doing other work reading on causal development, I simply came across several Japanese articles, some of them published even in the journal Science, Nature Science, and claiming that the Japanese culture has a simply different conception of nature, people living in the Japanese culture. They never really thought of it in terms of causes primarily, but rather in terms of kind of continuum between man and nature. So everything is in a way alive, and there isn't a sharp contrast between the observer and the observed. A lot of things that were said by educationists, still contemporaries, of course, working in modern Japan, for example, that Japanese children, adolescents, do not really understand properly that some things are the product of human industry, of technology, but simply assume that everything is just part of nature. Now, these things struck me as fairly, really implausible, I have to say, given the background of the research on causal development, even in infants. So I just thought, well, this is something that clearly only psychological research can answer, whether it is indeed the case that Japanese people and children think in this way. So that's how I designed a study and applied to, in fact, the Royal Society for a grant, which funded that part of the research, just to look at causal understanding in Japan, in children and adults, given this cultural background that they are said to have, which is everywhere in literature, in anthropology, history, and so on. And it was a really fascinating sort of time that I had with them. They were, first of all, they were very keen, very interested in talking to me about these things, which you would then find a little odd if they are totally unprepared to look at the world in this way. But the similarities were very obvious from the beginning. I should say that this is even more surprising because my colleagues, psychologists in Japan, tried to, in a way, not discourage me because I had already arrived there, but they simply were concerned that the Japanese children might not really understand what I was asking them about, because these things are not talked about in Japan, as they put it. To ask them how natural objects came into being and what sort of causes at the different levels were involved. So I, because I wasn't a fluent Japanese speaker ever, I had a very limited sort of for daily living while I was there. I had a research assistant, in fact two, one was working with me with adults, another one with children, and they were stunned in a way as much as I was. In fact, I wasn't stunned because of my hypothesis in a way predicted that, but I was very surprised how things can be perpetuated in the literature, which is studied everywhere in the world, that has never been checked out on the ground. Is this really how ordinary Japanese people think?
And the key finding was?
The key finding was that, for example, they had very similar ideas to how natural beings, natural things come into being as Western children, as British in this instance, because I started with them. So that the most surprising, in fact, was that they very often, regularly suggested that God was the creator of natural objects. Now, that's not something that they really consider a kind of a, it's difficult to put it in the right way, but to them, as I understood my colleagues and some religious scholars in Japan, it's almost an abomination, so to speak, to pretend to know that God does this and that and how God does it. Their conception of God as a transcendent being is so remote that you really shouldn't pretend to discuss it at all. They are critical quite a lot of Western, particularly of the Christian religion, in its theology. In Japanese, I understand there isn't even a word theology because they just wouldn't embark on such an enterprise to devise a theory about how God is. So that's the background against which, you see, these people had to... they developed their own private, of course, theory of the world, which is very similar to the theory of the world that Western children and adults have. Incidentally, I found the same thing with Japanese adults, which is even more striking because they are, adults are far more influenced by culture wherever they are. But they too, they did have some sort of specific patterns of difference compared to the Westerners. For example, many of them would adhere to the idea that the world, the matter, is eternal. No one created it, not even God. But life, a living organism, that is the work of God. So it is a kind of, obviously they are influenced, but not everybody. There are people, many Japanese adults, who simply had identical view to the Western adults.
Public atheists, the very vocal public atheists of the moment, insist that atheism really is the default position in human psychology, and that belief in God has to be imposed. You're saying that's not quite right.
I would say it's really the opposite, on the basis of the evidence that I have got and the evidence that other people in psychology and anthropology to some extent have. I think these atheists that you are citing or implying, one should obviously be aware that they are not speaking with any kind of evidence to hand. They didn't go to do any empirical work with people. These are just their assumptions or interpretations of not very systematic evidence, I would say. I'm not saying that people are fully fledged theists in the sense that they have a particular concept of God. That's not what I'm even looking at in my research. But it is a concept of causal agent, a unique one that is very distinct from the human agent and corresponds with many properties that we adults attach to God. That's all, as a causal agent.
I guess atheists would have been delighted if your research proved the opposite. But can I raise with you a few of their criticisms of your work when your work hit the headlines? The first is, some pointed out that part of your research or publication was supported by the Templeton Foundation, which is often portrayed by atheists as this shadowy religious organization that's seducing real scholars toward religion.
Well, there are a few things to say about that. I did have a grant from the Templeton Foundation, for which I was very grateful because it came at the right time, but it wasn't given to me to do any new research. It was really to write up what I had already done in Japan and Britain. Secondly, my experience of the Templeton Foundation is that they are actually quite rigorous and picky in what they fund. I didn't get funding straight away. There were very many. I have the impression that on their panel of peer reviewers, there are very many people who are atheists, and that's what the Templeton Foundation openly stands for, to have people of all sort of shades of belief to look more objectively at what's being proposed. So I wouldn't say that that's... It's a shame that there are people who think so, but that's not my impression at all. That's how it works.
The other criticism is that although you're in the psychology department here at Oxford University, you also have an associated position in the theology department, and a lot of atheists think theology isn't even a true academic discipline. And they would even question psychology as sort of a light science, not real science.
Well, this is, as you rightly say, Department of Experimental Psychology. So any research or claims that we send out from this department has to be based on empirical evidence. Now, the aim here, as in any other science, is to have your colleagues look at what you do. Or there are enormous ways of putting things in place to check against biases and so on. But I have to say that the researchers themselves really operate on that basis. I am not interested in doing research just in order to support any kind of ideas or preferences that I have, but just to see what it's there. In fact, I'm very interested in atheists, in the way that they think, and could be said that that's what I'm really trying to see when it begins to emerge in development. So my association with theology faculty is just on the basis of the teaching. In fact, I would say that the theology faculty has taken the very right attitude to, ask a psychologist to teach theology students rather than a theologian with some interest in psychology. So that, I think, gives some credit to the theology faculty as being seriously minded.
One of the recurring themes in the new atheism of the moment, particularly in Richard Dawkins' writings, an Oxford colleague, is that teaching children religion is a form of child abuse. It inhibits their natural curiosity, fills them with guilt, deludes them with stories. Can this case be made empirically, do you think, as a psychologist?
I really wonder what sort of observations Richard Dawkins has made about this. It totally fails to match anything that I have observed. I have done my latest, most recent project involves actually children from faith schools. There are several types of Christian faith schools, Muslim, Jewish, Hindu, and so on. Some of those schools could be said to be very, very religious or very structured along the religious lines. And then you would, of course, expect that all the children there would come out with the views definitely shaped by the teaching that they get. That's not at all the case. I have to say, I think Richard Dawkins ought to know that. The surprising thing is that even the children from the same school, subjected to the same type of teaching, actually form rather varied views on the same issues. And in my research, I do ask them the same questions about the same issues. So I do try to form comparisons that are fairly tight from school to school, from child to child. So that that is one piece of evidence that goes strongly against Richard Dawkins's claim. These children are not parroting what they are being told. They are even critical. I was very surprised to find children, for example, even from evangelical schools, from the Muslim school. Children, of course, do receive information that is given to them, but with a critical mind. That is the nature of human reasoning. I'm not sure that Richard Dawkins understands enough how cognition works, really.
Can I ask you a final sort of clarifying question? What do you think causes this early belief in some kind of creator being?
As I said briefly at the beginning, I think it's the it's really an aspect of human causal understanding, and that is a huge domain of our cognition. If you think about it seriously, we rely on our ability to understand the world in causal terms from day one. We need to distinguish things immediately according to what they do to us. Do they do to us harm or good, foods and so on. So even infants begin to form these causal associations very early on, and of course are able to reflect them, on them fairly soon. So I think it's this drive to interpret the world in causal terms, to master its causal laws, is what actually accommodates this more theoretical aspect of it. But what about the world itself? What about me? How did anything begin at all? I think it's there. Ideally, I would like to be able, of course, to find ways of taking even younger children than I have. But of course, you do depend on reasonably developed linguistic abilities for the children just to convey to you what they think. It's not that they do not think earlier than that, they do, but to put it across, you do need some language for that. There are now technologies that could be tried with brain imaging, but those are rather expensive, and there is no need really to resort to them as yet in this case. I think it's behavioral evidence that is perfectly adequate if it is obtained under properly designed and controlled conditions, and you have sufficient comparisons to allow you, and a large number of observations, of course. I mean, it's never enough. For example, this latest study, I have over 400 children, but it is a large number, but it's a small one if you look school by school. There are only 60 children per school and so on. So you do need a lot more before you can state something with greater, not certainty ever, never certainty in science, but probability really that things are as they are. So it is the behavioral evidence that that we need to continue to rely on.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Fabulous.
Well, I hope it's useful. I don't know, one always thinks that that there are
No, that was lovely. I'll get you to stay there.
One thing that I thought you might really ask me about in connection with adults was that...
Fire that up. I'll just check that. If you could just speak.
Oh, yes, sure.
Yeah, that's fabulous. Okay. You've also done some research into adults' statements about belief and unbelief, atheism. Could you tell us a little about that?
Yes, certainly. And that is, again, it might sound strange, but it is a developmental approach, because humans develop, they change across lifespan, and development is not always an upward sort of linear curve, but it has its... it depends on the domain of our cognition. Some concepts show very little change from childhood to adulthood, but some do change quite a lot. So it was this kind of interest to see whether there are any similarities between children and adults, and also where the differences are most pronounced. So the adults in my study were actually being tested in the same way as children, absolutely the same method, the same questions, in order to get at some very clear kind of comparisons. Of course, they can use a lot more sophisticated language to put their view across. But one of the things that struck me with adults was that many more of them, more adults than children, are sort of prepared to present their position as being an atheist. They simply do not think that God plays a part somewhere where children think so immediately. When I try to establish what exactly they mean by God, what kind of a concept they have, as I do with children, it turns out that you really need to be very careful about this, because adults tend to use a very idiosyncratic criteria, assuming that everybody else has a certain concept of God, whereas theirs is different. So they would tell me, I'm an atheist because I just don't believe in God as a man sitting in the sky, but I believe in some sort of spirit, energy, intelligence, and so on. So that, I mean, a child couldn't tell you that, but of course no child believes that God is a man in the sky. That's the interesting thing as well. The importance of asking people, of getting data from people directly under sort of very clear conditions is absolutely, it cannot be overstated, let me put it that way.
So there may be even fewer real atheists than the survey suggests.
I'm inclined to really suspect that to be the case, very much so. The other thing is that people tell you explicitly that they are not sure what they mean, and these are wonderful statements that I have from many subjects. So they tell me, well, I did think this way, but now I'm inclined to think that way, although it may change, they tell you. In a few cases, they do change during the session with me. I mean, that was really astonishing. They just, I suppose what the actual investigation that the method that I use with them does is force them just to focus in a very straightforward, clear way to sort out their thoughts. It was interesting that one, which I still remember, a very interesting participant said to me, it's just not a topic of conversation these days. She said, I haven't really sorted it out. I mean, these are the things that are precious coming from people to highlight the uncertainties, the lack of opportunities to talk about it. That's one striking thing. And I think that the reason that religion is so-called said to be on the increase, I'm not sure that it is. I think humans have always probably thought about the world in the same way, because the world hasn't changed and we haven't sort of evolved into something different. But what has changed these days is the opportunities to be provoked, to think about. So that gives the impression that there is something in the world of religion that has changed. I don't think so. I think it's just these opportunities to articulate the doubts, the certainties, the questions, the thing. And that is the same for children, incidentally. And it's very well observed, especially in faith schools, because faith schools just allocate a lot more time to these issues, which is really precious. I mean, that would be one of my probably conclusions or recommendations for all schools, faith or non-faith, just create more space for these things, for children to think about, to articulate their thoughts. It won't make anyone either a believer or an atheist, but they will really understand themselves a little bit better, and above all, understand that things might change. It's not the same. People tell me this. So I really did enjoy that part very much, with adults as well as children.